Blog Talk Radio.
Well, baby, it's cold outside. I'll tell you that much. This is a far cry from Seth, you being in Florida.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for someday. I thought you said these were working again. God damn it.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. So glad you could attend.
And then it worked, and then he turned it off. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Anyway, tonight on the show, we will talk about the State of the Union Address, Billy King's replacement, and all that's going on in Oregon. No, you've turned to the right show. This has nothing to do with any of those things, except maybe Billy King's replacement. I'm actually sitting outside the Barclays Center tonight, Seth and Sean Sports Radio, waiting for the New Jersey Nets.
The
Brooklyn Nets. I keep thinking New Jersey. The Brooklyn Nets versus the San Antonio Spurs B team, because we know that they don't ever play the A team when they can rest them. And tonight, of all nights, should be a restful night for the San Antonio Spurs. The New Jersey Nets finally, mercilessly for their fans, have decided that Billy King is no longer the general manager of this team. Seth, are you surprised by this whatsoever?
Well, first of all, it's not mercilessly, it's mercifully.
There you go.
No, this should have happened, from the day they, hired. Billy King should never have been hired as the GM. Billy King has a reputation for, he's someone who brings in people to keep his job. So, as long as you're consistent and mediocre in that 7-8, that is the thought process that's gone along with him. So, they brought in all these veterans and traded away all the youth. Because when you have an owner like Mikhail Prokhorov, the thought process is he wants a champion now. Now, again, he did this in Philly as well, but the trades that he has made, I don't kill him on some of them. I don't kill him for trading for Darren Williams in return for Derek Favors, Devin Harris in a first round. Because at that point, Williams was probably the number two or number three point guard in basketball. But the reality is he built a team that was old, incredibly over the cap, and no real way to become no real path to the championship. The team has not drafted well in years. Good riddance.
Yeah, at the end of the day, in the NBA, you need a superstar to win. And if you thought that Deron Williams was that superstar when you made that trade, okay, I can live with that. Once they got him and they realized he was not that superstar, anybody that had vision, and by vision I mean you could put on glasses and still have vision, knew that Kevin Garnett wasn't that at 38. Paul Pierce wasn't that at 37. And Joe Johnson wasn't that at whatever age he was when they acquired him. And yet they spent all their future holdings. This is like an investment banker that shorts a stock knowing that it's going to tank. Because there was no upside to these trades. Nobody thought that the players, those four players, were going to get better at their age. They could only go down. And now Billy King and Mikhail Prokhorov have mortgaged the future so much that the Nets do not have their rights to their first-round pick until 2020.
So it was 2019. And you're forgetting actually one of the other dumber trades made by King, trading a first-round pick, a non-conditional, just in non-capped first-round pick, Portland for Gerald Wallace.
Well, that was to be fair, that was made with one reason in mind, and that was to re-sign Deron Williams. And you had to prove to Deron Williams that they were going to play ball and spend the money. So that's the actual one I don't fault them for. Because if they believed at the time that Deron Williams was that superstar, then they needed to keep him. And that's the way that they went about keeping him.
Wallace already was on a downhill trend. in the trade for what you thought was going to be a top five point guard, a top five, excuse me, draft pick, is hysterical. He ended up, Nets ended up having the number six pick. Portland takes it, and of course, you know who they took with that pick, correct?
Well, if
Damian,
the Nets had taken,
Damian,
if
the
Nets
Damian
had,
Lord.
Look, if the Nets had taken somebody with that pick, his name was probably going to be Dennis Hobson, and we never would have heard from him. So, I mean, or Kerry Kittles, and we probably wouldn't have heard about him either.
Okay, no.
I mean,
Kerry Kittles had a nice career, but
I guess
the other issue being,
that's what I'm saying is you don't the person that is picked is not necessarily the person that the other team would pick either.
I understand that, but supposedly
okay.
King had stopped. King doesn't really scout. I mean, supposedly stopped scouting 3 months before the draft and decided the only three players he liked in the draft were Kidd Gilchrist, Thomas Robinson, and Anthony Davis. If this is true, this is not someone who should be a GM.
They're talking about replacements, and you knew this one guy was going to come up, right? I mean, he's coaching for Kentucky now. He used to coach for the New Jersey Nets before they came to Brooklyn. He's a big name. He's what Prokhorov wants, a big name in a big market. And he wants big money, according to, Voidovic. What the heck's that guy's name? I always forget.
Is it Adrian Wojnarowski at Yahoo?
Yeah, there you go, Wojnarowski. According to Wojnarowski, he wants 12 years and $120 million, 10 years and $120 million and full control. That's a lot of coin.
For a guy who, you know, is not a proven NBA winner. It's to show you the ridiculousness of King. We haven't even discussed that they fired the head coach as well, Lionel Hollins, who's a very solid coach, and I think we'll get another chance somewhere else. But this was a merciful, an absolute merciful firing of Lionel Hollins.
It's interesting because I did see a report, not a report, but I think Chad Ford said this best. He goes, look, if the Nets want to hire somebody as GM, they should go look at Philadelphia and go hire Sam Hinkie. He's used to this. Not only is he used to this, no, but they were being serious. Let's understand. Not only is he used to this, but he's used to pulling diamonds like second-round picks out of the rough, which is what the Nets are going to have to do in the next couple of years because they don't have first-round picks. So Prokhorov can go and buy second-round picks. He can go spend that money that he has in a good way and buy these second-round picks. But you need somebody that can mine the talent and go get those second-round picks and people that you can take a chance on. And I don't think that's a bad idea if Jerry Colangelo really is in charge there in Philadelphia now.
We'll see how that plays out. I do agree. It would be a bit intriguing if the Calipari, and I don't think the Calipari thing was going to play out. You know, it's shocking actually that we're even starting, considering the weekend we've just seen on the NFL, that we start with the firing of a GM. But considering the disgust we've shown for Billy King over the last 3 or 4 years, it's well warranted, and hopefully the Nets at some point by the end of the decade will be relevant again, although I'm not holding my breath. Speaking of irrelevant, and actually can't even make the segue, I tried, but I can't. I guess we start off with a very serious question. Who has the right to be more upset, Bengals fans or Vikings fans?
Did you just say Bengals fans or Vikings fans?
Yeah. Who would be more upset? If you look at those two. Who has the right to
be more upset? The Bengals fans have definitely more reason to be upset, and on many different levels. They have more reason to be upset.
They have the right to be more embarrassed.
Oh, definitely Bengals fans. I mean, I don't think there's any question. Look, okay, Blair Walsh, he missed a field goal. He did. And a field goal that's made 99% of the time this year. Okay, he did. But Blair Walsh is human. I mean, these mistakes are made. It's not like he compounded the mistake by saying, oh, yeah, let me go hit somebody. Or let me go bump a referee. he did do things that were out of the realm of the game. And he made a mistake. Look, Scott Norwood missed a field goal. I mean, Ray Finkel missed a field goal. No, I'm just kidding. But he did.
Finkel, Einhorn, Finkel?
I know Seth has no idea who Ray Finkel is, but...
Yes, I knew who it was. I've never seen the movie.
Okay. I think when you're a Bengals fan, you have to look at your coach, you have to look at your players, you have to look at your defensive coordinator and say, excuse me? Now, you're playing with a ticking time bomb with Vontaze Burfict and Adam Jones, but you also have to look at the refs and say, why on God's green earth was Jerry Porter allowed on that field? I'm still bewildered that he wasn't given a penalty for being on that field, because according to the NFL rules, the only people that are allowed to be on the field during an injury are the head coach and the trainers. And last time I checked, Jerry Porter is neither.
The reason that I ask about this is not per se even the Minnesota game today, yesterday. A game they should have won, a game scored a fluke touchdown for all intents and purposes on a fumbled snap that led to a 35-yard pass. But you look at Minnesota's history. Going back, we have, starting with the Hail Mary game in 1975 against the Cowboys in the NFC title. I don't remember if it was a title or divisional game. You have 87, Darren Nelson, getting stopped on the goal line in the NFC title game. You have in 98, the great Randy Moss team that went 15-1, and Gary Anderson, who hadn't missed a field goal all year, misses one, and they lose in overtime to Atlanta. In 2009, the Brett Favre team, probably the best team in the league, loses to New Orleans on a couple terrible passes in overtime. And now this. And, you know, Cincinnati, and I actually am a Cincinnati fan, as you know, is not, you know, they have not quite had, the fans have had annoyances and frustrations, you know, with Carson Palmer. Probably they could have been a Super Bowl team the year Carson Palmer gets knocked out in the first play of the wild card. But they have not had the cumulative effect. Of course, they had the Montana to Taylor pass. But they have not had the cumulative effect, I think, of what the Viking fans have gone through for the last 40 years. That's why I made the comparison.
However, the Bengals haven't won a playoff game in 25 years. 25 years. I mean, the last time the Bengals won a playoff game, I had just been bar mitzvahed. That's a long time ago. I mean, really, you and I were in eighth grade. Maybe ninth grade by the last time that they won. And we're pushing 40, my friend. So, I mean, they haven't won a playoff game. Yes, Montana to Taylor, that's a pretty big thing going on here. And the way that they lost it, I think, has them having the right to be more upset. I think just the way that they lost it. Because, man, I don't know how... It could be any more devastating for a fan watching that game saying, we don't have Andy Dalton, we're going behind A.J. McCarron, we haven't played well the first half of the game at all, and here we are in the second half, our quarterback has surprisingly woken up, Catherine Webb must have been in the stands, and Brett Musburger must have been putting the finishing touches on here. And here we are, with less than a minute to go, and they're on their own 50 and one down to go. And we throw a pass. Okay, Antonio Brown gets hit. Yeah. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, that was definitely a defenseless receiver. Penalty warranted. So now they have a 50-yard field goal to win it with 18 seconds left and no timeouts. And then Joey Porter comes on the field, and Adam Jones reacts to what Joey Porter said, and now it's not a 50-yard field goal, but it's basically an extra point.
And, of course, under no circumstances should they even come down to that, considering Cincinnati had the ball with a minute to go after Vontaze Burfict has an interception of Landry Jones, runs like he's Jesse Owens going out, going into, or runs like he's Bo Jackson, actually,
going 70 yards and running right through the entrance into the stadium. And then Jeremy Hill fumbles the first ball. How do you not have seven hands on that ball making sure it's not – making sure there's no fumble?
No disagreement. So you're basically padding my rationale here.
I think either rationale is valid. Minnesota, the idea that the best one of the two or three best kickers in football missing a 25-yard field goal by about 87 feet is incomprehensible to me. And the thing I go back to is Minnesota outplayed Seattle. Cincinnati did not outplay Pittsburgh. But now we're going to have a game. And the thing is, with Dalton back, if Dalton came back next week and New England is still banged up, Denver, the quarterback and running back situation is in flux, I think they would have a very legitimate chance to run the table and go to the Super Bowl. Antonio Brown, we don't even know if he's hurt. Now Adam Jones just declared on ESPN that Brown was faking the whole thing and winked at him while he was on the ground. So if Brown is hurt, if Roethlisberger is hurt, it's a weakened team. And Andrew Jones is not leading that team to the Super Bowl. So we'll see how it plays out. Ramifications so you're looking at Kansas City, New England, and Denver, Pittsburgh. Two pretty fun games. Pretty interesting games, to say the least.
Well, I think the New England game, and we can preview these games now and then after this talk about the national title game or the State of the Union address, whichever one you care to talk to, or Donald Trump just being an idiot and talking about football, but that's just another sidebar. So Kansas City is going up to New England. New England has been without Sebastian Vollmer. They've been without Julian Edelman. They've been without Danny Amendola. They finally got back Gronkowski. Their offensive line is putrid at best, and we saw that against Miami. But the loss of Jeremy Maclin, I think, hurts them more playing against New England than it would have been playing against Denver. Because I think Denver neutralizes Maclin anyway. I think the running game against New England is harder than the passing. Their defense is much better against a run than it is the pass. I think I don't think Kansas City goes in there and takes out a win, as much as I'll be rooting for them, because we know it's a Jets fan's second season. It's called root for the Jets until they don't make the playoffs, and then let's root for everybody that plays the Pats.
I do tend to agree with you. I have trouble seeing this Kansas City team, and yes, they look very, very good in beating a very, very mediocre Houston Texans team. And really what the wild card established is what we've said all along about the season. The NFC East is not very good, and the NFC South is not very good. And, this was proven. The Redskins, who had a nice year, got outclassed, it looked like, by Green Bay in the second half. And Kirk Cousins came back to earth. Aaron Rodgers looked like Aaron Rodgers. And they pretty much cruised after a pretty weak start, and part of that in part to Deshaun Jackson, who for some reason forgot to put the football in the end zone. I don't really know why. And Houston, who is just straight out awful, and confirmed the fact that they will be drafting a quarterback with their first pick, losing 30-0, and Brian Hoyer with 5, I believe, turnovers. I agree with you. I just have trouble seeing Kansas City in offense that week without their second best player. Their best player is probably their tight end, Kelsey, going to Fox and winning a game in New England in the playoffs. I just don't see it.
Yeah, as much as I would hope. I mean, it's just, to me, that's just not going to happen. I was incredibly impressed by Seattle, though, yesterday. If not their offense, and certainly their defense. Look, that defense has come back. Michael Bennett is a one-man wrecking machine now. And they go to Carolina, which to me is the best game of the weekend. I believe it's the early game on Sunday.
Yep.
And that's a very hard matchup for me to make a prediction on. I'm going to take Carolina just because they're home and they're well-rested. But I wouldn't be the least bit surprised if this is another 10-9, 10-7, 13-10 game. I don't see this as being a very high-scoring game. The defenses are just too good.
Yeah, I was not quite as impressed with Seattle's defense as you were. They played against a mediocre offensive team in Minnesota. And, you know, in horrible, horrible weather, if you saw some of the long passes going deep, they looked like the Steve Grogan passes from Super Tecmo Bowl. They went about 80 yards up in the air and just plopped down. And when it came down to it, you know, you looked at when it came down to it, Minnesota got the ball to the 10-yard line for the chance to win the game. And it just happened that Walsh missed the kick. So I was not quite as overwhelmed. I was not quite as impressed. A stupid play by Cam Chancellor on a pass interference. Look, they're a very good defense. I do like Carolina. I think it is a heck of a matchup. Carolina, I think, is just – I also, without Marshawn Lynch, who knows if he's going to play next week. We're still trying to figure out why he didn't play this week. I don't know. I don't know what we're looking at from a running back perspective. Christian Michael is not going to run on Kalon Short and Luke Kuechly and Kuechly. Excuse me. It's not. I Josh Norman, I think, can beat Doug Baldwin. I like Carolina. I think it's a good game. I think Carolina wins by about four, probably something on the lines, about 27-23.
Oh, much higher scoring game for you. Okay, let's moving on to Denver and Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh, I thought, would have a really good chance if everybody was healthy. Unfortunately, nobody's healthy. It's my opinion, my non-medical opinion, based on looking at the way Big Ben went down, is that he has a separated shoulder. Couldn't throw on the drive that he came back. He obviously was not well enough to play in the game to begin with. Also, Landry Jones never would have been in there. So I think Denver wins and wins pretty easily. But I got to tell you, did you not like the play of Ryan Shazier on Saturday night? I got to tell you, my man crush is getting better and better.
Your man crush continues. Yeah, he was a monster.
12 tackles, the forced fumble on Jeremy Hill. Man, that guy's going to be a player. And we'll see him next year on the Seth and Sean Sports Radio fantasy team once again, because there's no way anybody's getting their hands on my man crush.
He also knocked Gio Bernard unconscious, he looked like a monster, a man among boys out there last week. I agree with you. I think if Pittsburgh is healthy, it's a winnable game. But you look at the team, we don't know if, assuming Brown is injured, even if he can play, he's not going to be at 100%. Roethlisberger is certainly not at 100%, couldn't throw the ball downfield during the game. Obviously, Le'Veon Bell is out for the season. D'Angelo Williams isn't healthy. Roethlisberger has a sprained AC joint. Brown has a concussion. Williams has his right ankle sprain. These are not injuries that people recover from in a week. And I think Pittsburgh's run in here as well. Again, if they were healthy, I think I would have taken them. I'm not in love with Denver's offense at all. But I think Denver wins around 24-13. The one we should say, and we're happy to hear, even though Macklin may not play next week, this looked a lot more serious than it actually was, considering he's coming off of two torn ACLs. This is a high ankle sprain, so there is a chance he comes back, as opposed to the third ACL, which they thought it could be. So, anyway.
No, agreed. So we got one more game to pick. And... man, I just went totally blank.
Arizona's at home against Green Bay.
There we go. Arizona and Green Bay.
I think the last time they played was one of the most fun football games. Last time they played a playoff game, I believe, was the Arizona-Green Bay 51-45 game the year Arizona went to the Super Bowl with Kurt Warner. And they won, I think, on a Green Bay fumble in the end zone. in overtime. I don't think this game is going to be that close. Yes, Green Bay looked good yesterday. However, this is not the Redskins offense. Redskins defense. This is the Giants. This is the This is the Cardinals defense. Significant difference, to say the least. Arizona is healthy. They're rested. I think it's a fun game. I think they win. I think they score a touchdown late to put it away into double digits, something on the lines of 31-20.
Okay, I was going to go 30-17, so we're pretty close on that one. So we got the four games. So we think. Wait, is it all four home teams?
We have all four home teams.
And I have three in an away because I got Seattle winning in Carolina. So,
oh no! I thought you had Carolina.
Oh no. Okay. I believe that Seattle will beat Carolina. If I did not say that before, if there was any misconception, I think it will be three home teams and an away team, which means Arizona will get to host the championship game against Seattle, which would be another fantastic game. I'd very much look forward to that. And then you have Manning and Brady again in Denver again, and hopefully Raheem Moore will be nowhere near the playing surface.
I don't think he's in Denver anymore. So I think other football to talk about. A couple coaches let go after we hung up last week. The most shocking one, Lovie Smith, fired from Tampa. And apparently that frustrated the entire Tampa Bay team, including mostly their defense. The thought process is that Dirk Koetter, their offensive coordinator, was going to get a job elsewhere, and that was why they fired Lovie to keep him in place. Is Dirk Koetter really worth firing Lovie Smith?
Oh, I don't think so, but I think, look, Lovie Smith was mediocre. He won four games this year. He won three games last year.
No,
oh,
he jumped four. He went from 2-14 to 6-10.
6-10, sorry, six games this year. But still mediocre, right? No playoff wins, no playoffs at all. And in a difficult division, I'll grant you that, but it really depends on when it gets to coaches, it depends on whether you feel you have a long-term solution. I think it's the same thing as when you get to a quarterback. Do you have a long-term solution? Do you have a solution for 3 to 4 years, which you believe you can win a Super Bowl with? And if you don't, and you're willing to eat the money, you go do that. And these coaches, these owners who make billions of dollars don't fret about eating $14 million. And that's exactly what happened. That's what happened in San Francisco with Tom Insula. That's what happened with Lovie Smith. In some ways, you could say that happened with Tom Coughlin, in that they did not think that he was a long-term solution, so they ate the money that he was owed. That's what happened with Chip Kelly. These guys, the owners, do not believe that these are the long-term solutions. They are in win-now mode. And if they're not the long-term solution, then they're the problem. Now, do you believe Adam Gase is the long-term solution in Miami? I think that's a better question.
Well, the most interesting thing I read about Miami last week, Adam Gase was the offensive coordinator in Denver 2 years ago and then followed John Fox to Chicago, where he upped their offense significantly despite a very injury-plagued year from Matt Forte. Kevin White, the first-round pick, that never got stepped on the field, and Brandon Marshall was traded. But he did give Jay Cutler a very good year, or one of his best years, actually. I don't know. I don't know enough. It's hard for me to determine. Miami's such an underachieving team with relatively good talent. The question is Ryan Tannehill the quarterback that they need to take them to the next level? Apparently, Joe Philbin didn't think so. According, I don't remember if this was ESPN or Sports Illustrated, Philbin actually wanted Miami to draft Derek Carr 2 years ago, which was only 2 years after they drafted Tannehill in the first place. Tannehill, a mediocre year. His stats have been fine, but the team, you know, with talent like Lamar Miller, with talent like and Donovan Sue, with talent like Jarvis Landry, you know, unable to do anything. You know, 6-10 in a decent but not overwhelming NFC East. I don't know if he's the answer, but he is the hot coordinator, and that's what Steven Ross was going to go. He was going to make a splash, and this was a splash that could be done quickly. And the thought process, I believe, was if they didn't take him soon, someone else was going to jump on him quickly.
So I think you have to look, as much as you bash some owners for taking their time, I think you have to give credit where credit is due. And Steven Ross, I give him a lot of credit. He wanted this guy. He went and got this guy. It kind of reminds you of a fantasy football auction draft where you can spend your money and wait till the next guy comes along. You can spend a little bit of money, maybe make or not get your guy, or you could go in big and get your guy. And he went and got his guy. There's something to be said for going to get your guy. So supposedly he's a quarterback guru, like you said before. Maybe he solves the Tannehill problem because they are invested in this guy. And if they wanted to start all over again, they could have. But I don't see them down in Miami looking that way. Now, your boy, or your ex-boy, I guess at this point, Mr. Coughlin, interviewing not only in Philadelphia, but also today, reports are that he is interviewing in San Francisco, which seems a little out of the ordinary to me. What do you think about that?
I think the whole thing is weird. I kind of understand the Philly philosophy, although I find it a little bit strange that to see a guy jump from, you know, someone who left the Giants under good terms as you can really ask for, to jump to one of their arch rivals, I find a bit strange. I mean, we see it with players all the time. I guess with coaches, it's not. Now, the idea being that, you know, Chip Kelly has kind of destroyed this franchise. This is the thought process. And you kind of need a little bit of a disciplinary, you know, a kind of more of a straight up football guy to kind of focus it a little bit more. So I think that's the process, the thought that that Jeffrey Lurie has in Philly. San Fran is weird because San Fran is a straight rebuilding project. You know, they lost so much talent this year. Patrick Willis, Chris Borland, Anthony Davis, Frank Gore, Michael Crabtree, I guess. I forget if he was the year before or not. I think he was the year before. You know, this is a team that's going to take 2, 3, 4 years to rebuild to be at a certain level. I don't see Coughlin taking a rebuilding job at this point. So I don't find that. I find that a very strange fit.
Yeah, so there are still a couple of coaching vacancies still out there. I mean, you have Tennessee. Buffalo is definitely not one of them because Sexy Rexy, armed with his extension, along with Doug Whaley, who is the GM, also armed with an extension, today brought Rob Ryan on the staff. Nepotism at its best, ladies and gentlemen. All I need is one of my brothers to become an NFL coach, and I'll have a job. That's what this tells me. And neither one of my brothers knows anything about football. So
yeah,
that's unlikely,
that
to say the least.
I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Unfortunately not. But I would like it to happen. And if there are any college football coaches that are out there that want a guy just – I don't know, I could probably do as good a job as Rob Ryan did on defense for the Saints. So I'm here. Just let me know.
Giants submitted a request to interview Hugh Jackson today, the offensive coordinator of Cincy. I'm kind of indifferent about this. I really like the Giants offensive coordinator, Ben McAdoo. And I would see them go, you know, I don't have a problem with either of their coordinators, I guess is the problem. I like their, you know, the problem is they have absolutely no offensive talent, no defensive talent here. I think that, the Mariners have never been people who've tried to make a splash out of anything. It's just not their way. Do you see them going, the Giants going? I see the Giants going defense. Do you see them going offense?
Well, I'll tell you one person they're not going is Marvin Lewis. So in the Bate Owls, you can stop asking for him. He's not coming. He's not even being let out of his Cincinnati contract. So no Marvin Lewis to the Giants, being said. For anybody that would like to follow that along, follow Nabate on Facebook, and you'll see what we're talking about. It was about a 20-minute conversation yesterday. Anyway, Hugh Jackson with the Giants. Remember, there are a couple of things that go into Hugh Jackson. I'm not saying this is the reason that the Giants interviewed him, but there is a thing called the Rooney Rule. You do have to interview an African-American or a Latino, a minority candidate, in order to comply with the Rooney Rule. And Hugh Jackson, whether being played or not, I can guarantee there is at least one of those interviews, one of the interviews, that is meant to satisfy the Rooney Rule, whether that is for the Giants or for some other team. So I always look at these Hugh Jackson, Jamie Henderson, these types of interviews with a little grain of salt, because you have to ask. But Jamie Henderson, well, that's the thing, right? Jamie Henderson is the defensive backs coordinator, defensive backs position coach for the Dallas Cowboys. And he was on the Fritz Pollard Alliance, is the alliance that gives out the four or five minority coaches, which they believe should have representation in the NFL, at least for interviews, and Jamie Henderson was one of them. If you recognize the name, Jamie Henderson was a defensive back for the Jets a while back. So that might have something to do with it. But anyway, I looked at these interviews with a little bit of skepticism. You know, I have said this for 2 years now. I believe Ben McAdoo will be the head coach of the New York Football Giants. Said that since the day he was hired. The day that Tom Coughlin quits, retires, gets fired, will be the day that Ben McAdoo will ascend to the throne. And I think that this is a little compromise for Eli Manning, who they want to keep and they want to keep happy, in that if they weren't going to keep Coughlin, they got to keep the offense in check. I don't believe that a new coach should have to keep any coordinator that he doesn't want. I think trying to put a coordinator, I don't believe that a coach should have to keep a coordinator at all. I think it's not his show then. If you're going to hire somebody to run the show, look, you're not hiring him to buy the groceries. You're hiring him to make the meal. He should be able to make the entire meal and not just half of it with one hand behind his back. I think if you push a coordinator on a coach, you're doing exactly that, especially one like Ben McAdoo, who's basically a coach in waiting anyway.
Agreed. And there's still a lot of jobs, still many jobs open, San Francisco, Philly. We talked about the Giants. You know, I'm interested to see if Detroit keeps their head coach. I believe they hired a GM this weekend, I think. And they'll be talking with him.
Bob Quinn.
That's right. So, about 20 minutes left to go to the show.
There is something very important on TV tonight besides the State of the Union address.
Oh, that's right. State of the Union.
There is something called the NCAA Championship game.
There is. I agree with
and
you.
And it's not on New Year's Eve. So ESPN or CBS should not have to pay $20 million back to their advertisers for bad ratings. Because that's what happened. But anyway, so we have this the NCAA championship game, the second of its kind with the playoff. The first one was won by Ohio State last year with Cardale Jones. And here we are with Nick Saban back in the swing of things, with the number 2 Alabama Tide, Crimson Tide, and versus the Clemson Tigers, who are trying to become the first team, and I did not know this until I looked it up, the first team to go 15-0 since 1898, and that team was Rutgers University.
It was also the last year that Rutgers was ranked in college football.
But on bump.
Exactly. We have Clemson, Alabama tonight. It should be a heck of a game. We have the Heisman winner, Derrick Henry, Heisman finalist, Deshaun Watson. I think this game comes down to whether Shaq Lawson, the All-American defensive lineman who got injured in the game against Oklahoma, is able to play. I think he's the only – with him, I think he's their mainstay. Without him, I think it's going to be very difficult to stop Alabama. And I find it kind of an interesting, because you look at what Michigan State you know, D'Antonio, a great coach, you know, set up all this, set up everything to stop Derrick Henry, and then Jacob Coker threw for 270 and like three touchdowns. It's a really tough call. I think both teams are worthy. I think both teams are very, very good. I think my heart says Clemson, my head says Alabama.
Well, I don't think it's that tough. I just don't. I think Alabama plays on a different level. They kind of play like Kentucky in the NCAA basketball teams. When they're right, they're right, and they are winning. And I don't think this is a close game at all, Seth. I think they win by two touchdowns, at least. I think it's a 27-10 game. I think there probably is a late touchdown to make it that much. I don't think it's close past the end of the first half. I think Alabama pretty much dominates the ball. They're able to run it. Shaq Lawson is not 100% by any stretch of the imagination. And I think that, look, all Alabama has to do is control the ball. And I think you're going to see a lot of running, very little passing from Alabama. And Lane Kiffin is going to win Alabama just with him. Lane Kiffin, and I think you'll see a couple of surprise plays, but Alabama wins 27-10, and it's not close after the first half.
I'm not a fan of Alabama. So, well, I grew up, surprisingly, I actually grew up rooting for Clemson Tide. So, as I said, I wonder if how much of this is my head, the head versus the heart thing, but I do think Alabama wins the national championship. Saban wins, I believe, what is this, his fifth national title, putting him only behind Bear Bryant on the all-time list. So, did you have a chance? Now, a couple other things. Segueing out of football a little bit. We finally have the second Met elected to the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. Now, a question for you. As a diehard Met fan, but yet also the biggest backer of Tim Raines that I know, who would you have been more satisfied with having made the Hall of Fame, Mike Piazza or Tim Raines?
Oh, Tim Raines, without a doubt. Look, Mike Piazza, if he didn't get elected this year, he had seven more years to get elected, and I don't think that he shouldn't have even waited this long, but seven more years, there wasn't going to be an issue. Raines has one more year, one more. Now, he had a big jump, which is great, but there have been players that have made that big jump and not made it. Gil Hodges, Nellie Fox. Now, Fox did make it in by the Veterans Committee, but Gil Hodges is not. I'm not sure Gil Hodges was a Hall of Famer. Gil Hodges is deceased, so I can say was at that time. Layla, it's okay, babe. I'm here. And that's Seth's dog barking in the background. But at the same time, Tim Raines is a Hall of Famer. Tim Raines has as many times on base as Tony Gwynn does. Tim Raines is the second most dominant leadoff hitter in Major League Baseball history, behind only one, Ricky Henderson, who unfortunately he played at the exact same time with. And if there is no Ricky Henderson, Tim Raines sails into the Hall of Fame. I mean, sails it. It's not even close. So I would have been much happier had Raines get in. And what was interesting was I was listening to the broadcast because I had just gotten home from work. I'm listening to Baseball Hall of Fame, and they say, they introduce Mike Piazza, and I go, yes, Piazza got in. Then they start the introduction of Ken Griffey Jr., and they go, and the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame says, the second and final, and expletive after expletive after expletive came out of my mouth, where I'm saying, are you kidding me? Second and final, which means Raines didn't get in. And Bagwell didn't get in. Both have deserved it. I mean, we've had this discussion, you and I, you, me, and Abate, and everybody that wants to listen to me. Tim Raines is a Hall of Famer. Jeff Bagwell is a Hall of Famer. I still have yet to come around on the Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens. And they didn't get a big jump this year, so I don't expect them ever to be in the Hall of Fame.
Well, they did jump up to about 50%, both of them. But when you look, what's interesting is, yes, Tim Raines is going into his last year of eligibility, but it looks pretty good. When you look at who's coming in for next year for the 17, hard to imagine we're talking 2017 in the middle of January. You look who's coming in. The top four names are Vlad Guerrero, Jorge Posada, Manny Ramirez, and Pudge Rodriguez. Manny Ramirez and Pudge Rodriguez both had PED scandals that kind of plagued them by the end of their careers. Jorge Posada, I mean, I'm a Yankee fan. Jorge Posada is not a Hall of Famer. And Vlad Guerrero, a great offensive player, a Hall of Famer, but not somebody I would see as a first ballot Hall of Famer. Not someone I'm jumping to see go into the Hall of Fame. I think Tim Raines has a very good chance of getting in next year.
Well, but Seth, I think that's my inherent problem with the Hall of Fame, and I think you just said it. He's not a first ballot Hall of Famer. Why not? If he's a Hall of Famer, he's a Hall of Famer. Shouldn't matter whether he's first ballot, second ballot, third ballot, or fourth ballot. These guys should not incrementally make it. I understand that's the process and what goes on, but your statement of he's not a first ballot Hall of Famer, is he a Hall of Famer or not?
Well, again, the way that it has played out over the years, and we've talked about the Hall of Fame versus the Hall of Great versus the Hall of Very Good. And the Hall of Great, you know, the way it's played out is the Hall of Great gets in on the first ballot. The Hall of Very Good gets in over time. Vlad Guerrero was a very, very good player. Vlad Guerrero was not, I don't think, was an all-time great player. So because of that, I don't put him in the first ballot. I'm not saying that's right. I'm saying that's how it is.
Okay, and I understand that. I don't believe Vlad Guerrero is a Hall of Famer, period. I think he had some very good seasons. I think you can put him up. He had one MVP season. He never won a World Series. He played a lot in Montreal. I mean, he's comparable to Andre Dawson, but I don't believe Andre Dawson's a Hall of Famer either. So, I mean, he's six of one, half dozen the other. He's very similar to Jim Wright, another guy I don't believe is a Hall of Famer. These guys are in the Hall of Very Good, as you would say, but not in the Hall of Fame today. I don't believe Vlad should be there. I love to watch. Look, if you could not enjoy watching Vladimir Guerrero hit the ball, you really weren't a baseball fan, because that guy never took a pitch. I mean, there was a comment once made by about Mark. Do you remember a baseball player named Mark Gorizelonik? Shortstop.
Yeah, he was a second base. Okay,
shortstop. Second base,
yeah.
Shortstop, yeah. So he was playing in Kansas City, and he made the All-Star team. He batted 311, and he had, I believe it was like 200 hits, and played a sparkling second base. And some guy went up to Alan Baird, who was the general manager for the Royals at that time, and said, man, if that Gorizelonik could take a pitch and take a walk, he'd be an all-star every year. Now Alan Baird looked at him and goes, if he could take a pitch or take a walk, he wouldn't be playing in Kansas City. And that's the same thing I say for Vlad. Vlad was a great player, but he never took a pitch or a walk. And that set him apart from Manny Ramirez, who is, if take away the PEDs, is a first ballot Hall of Famer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so that's the difference between Manny Ramirez and Vladimir Guerrero, is that Vlad could never take a pitch. By the way, that's the difference between Tony Gwynn and Tim Raines. Flat out.
Running through his stats quickly, .318 career average, 181 steals, which surprises me. I forgot he stole 40 bases in a season once.
Yep.
449 homers, 1,400 RBIs, played 14 years, one World Series, one Cy Young, about, looks like about eight All-Stars, nine All-Star teams. But when I'm playing on baseballreference.com, and the similarities are interesting. So the names that you've brought up, it's either the high-level players who have not yet made the Hall of Fame or the kind of lower-tier Hall of Famers. Miggy Cabrera, who is a Hall of Famer. I don't think there's a question about that.
Yep.
Jeff Bagwell, who in your mind is a Hall of Famer. Larry Walker, who probably should have gotten more credit towards the Hall of Fame than he did, although I don't think I would have him in. Jim Rice, borderline at best. Willie Stargell, borderline at best. Billy Williams, borderline at best. Todd Helton, very good, not great. Duke Snyder, borderline at best. Andres Galarraga and Carlos Beltran. So it is kind of, he is kind of in that peripheral, you know, the pantheon of very good, probably not the pantheon of great. So is next year the year? You know, with these names that I've put in, I don't see Pudge getting in on a first round, on a first run. You know, understanding your argument, but as a PED guy, I just can't imagine anyone's going to get in on their first run. So I think you're looking at Bagwell and Reigns.
Look, it would be the first thing that Bate Isles and I would shake hands on right away within 5 seconds, is that we are both big proponents of Tim Raines. And, as long as he goes into the Hall of Fame sliding head first, he'll be okay.
Yeah, and kind of interesting, when you're in front of a computer, we'll take a look at some future years. I mean, 18 looks pretty weak as well. It's Chipper Jones, who is a first ballot Hall of Famer. Scott Rowland, Jim Thome, Omar Vizquel. Jim Thome will be an interesting, you know, Jones is easy. Jim Thome will be an interesting discussion. I'm guessing at 600 home runs, he'll probably make it. But, you know, not someone who I ever considered one of the best players in baseball.
But I'll tell you, Seth, I'll tell you, the most interesting discussion is not going to be Jim Thome. It'll be Omar Vizquel. Omar Vizquel, I believe, has 2,400 hits, which is a good amount for a shortstop. He has 13 gold gloves, universally the best fielder of his generation at shortstop, and batted, I think, 280 or 290. There's not much difference between him and Ozzie Smith, except Ozzie won a World Series and has a home run call that is fantastic from Jack Buck, and also can do a backflip. But other than that, not much difference between Ozzie Smith and Omar.
Ozzie was also one of the faces of baseball in an era.
Agreed.
A non-offensive, more of a defensive era of baseball. I remember when Vizquel retired, this was a discussion. I haven't thought too much about it, to be honest, since then. But if it's someone who gets in, he's not going to be someone at the top of my priority list to get in. And then in 19, you know, just kind of going forward, in 19, you have Roy Halladay, Todd Helton, Andy Pettit, Mariano Rivera. Rivera will be easy. Halladay is probably not good, is close, but probably not enough. And I don't think he may not have been good for long enough.
I love how you say Rivera is so easy. Because, yeah, Mariano Rivera, look, there will be no debate. He is the best reliever of all time. I mean, I don't say anything different to that degree. However, he's still a reliever. And
yes, but there is a precedence for relievers. There is no precedence for the DH.
And I'll tell you, with that type of class next year, I think you're going to see a little bit of a breakthrough for Edgar Martinez. I'm not sure he makes it yet, but he's got 3 years to get there. And if there's a DH that should get there, I think Edgar should get there. And then you have David Ortiz in 6 or 7 years.
Right, but the problem with Ortiz, again, you have the PED issue, and that comes into play.
Yep.
And that's it's a difficult call. Because, again, one of the faces of baseball, on the positive, on the negative, he's
the only thing with David Ortiz in regards to PEDs is that he was supposedly on that list in 2003, I believe it was, that Sports Illustrated got supposedly on that list that was never supposed to be released. Now, there were 130-some-odd people on that list, and only five of them got released, supposedly. So I'm not sure how much you can hold that against him. I really don't.
Without that, I think despite, relatively mediocre beginning of his career in Minnesota, the last 12, 15 years in Boston, really been something to behold. We got about 5 minutes to go. So is there anything you want to discuss?
Well, I don't have much to discuss other than I hope that that Donald Trump goes to see concussion, because he said that the NFL players are not tough enough anymore, and that he thinks that football is not a great sport anymore because they have weakened the game sufficiently enough that it is not a tough sport. I don't know if you've seen concussion yet. I certainly have. I've seen it now twice. I behoove anybody. Look, it may not be 100% accurate. That's okay. The science is 100% accurate. And I hope that you go see this, because it took me a little bit of time to come back and say, yes, I still want to watch football. And the only reason that I still do it is because now people understand the risks that they're taking. If they didn't understand those risks, they wouldn't be playing it. And to me, that was the most important thing behind concussion. Speaking of which, and I'm trying to get Syracuse today, there was a football player that passed away who was homeless in Syracuse. I can't find it. Darn it. I had it as my last 5 minutes. So, Seth, why don't you go ahead and I'll see if I can find this guy.
Very, very rarely. Here you go, Robert Washington. Is that who you're?
No, that wasn't his name. No.
Okay. Very rarely do you see. We're talking about the 1-2 Clemson Alabama game tonight. Very rarely do you see a 1-2 game which warrants hype. Possibly the best regular season game I've ever seen occurred last Monday night between number 1 Kansas and number 2 Oklahoma. A game so good that after Kansas won in triple overtime, and Oklahoma's best player, Buddy Hield, was being interviewed by ESPN, he got a standing ovation from the Kansas fans at Allen Fieldhouse. He scored 46. The game, as a Maryland fan, is number 3. Would I have loved for us to jump to number 2? Sure. But I have no argument, and no one can. The game was unbelievable. A game worth watching on ESPN Classic, a game worth watching. As I've complained for several years, that the quality of college basketball has decreased severely over the last few years. It's games like this that kind of bring you back to where it should have been. Heald scored 46. Perry Ellis was great for Kansas. Wayne Seldon Jr. was great for Kansas. And Dick Vitale sounded like the Dick Vitale I enjoyed listening to 25 years ago. So, if you can find that game on ESPN Classic or on it on the Ocho or whatever channel it should be, I would highly advise checking it out, even if it's for a certain period of time. So, did you find what you were looking for?
I can't find the guy's name. So what I will say is, have you made your reservation in Houston yet? Are you at that point where you're willing to do this? Come on, you have to move along. The Final Four is coming in April, so we have to get that going. All right, with that in mind, hopefully by next week, Seth will make his reservation. This is Sean Palmer for Seth Kamen, BackSportsPage.com, Blog Talk Radio. Really had a good time tonight. We'll talk to you next week with some more NFL action and the NCAA Championship. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.